Welcome to episode 7 of Stories of Recovery podcast. This episode is called Eating Disorders and Recovery. The podcast is a collaboration between Mental Health Ireland and the HSE Cavan Monaghan Mental Health Services as part of the Connecting for Life strategy to reduce suicide in our communities. My name is Miffy Hode and I'm a Development Officer with Mental Health Ireland. I host the conversations here on the Stories of Recovery podcast. It's widely recognised that the sharing of personal narrative and lived experience of surviving and recovering from adverse events in life offers hope and inspiration to those who may be going through something similar. It's been shown to promote help-seeking behaviour and encourage people to reach out for support when needed. It's our intention that the conversations we have here on this series of podcasts will bring hope and inspiration to you, the listener, and encourage you to reach out should you need support. We also hope that the conversations here add meaning to the experience of the contributors in helping to spread the word that recovery is real and possible, even from the most difficult of experiences. A list of supports and services can be found in a link below the podcast and will also be announced at the end of this recording. Thanks for listening, and let me introduce you to our theme and guests today. In this episode, we're talking about eating disorders and recovery, and the conversation takes place in the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services offices on the St. Davenant's complex in Monaghan Town. I met there with Sheila Nocton and Caroline Larmer. Sheila is a broadcaster who shares her story of recovering from an eating disorder. Caroline is a psychiatric nurse who specialises in eating disorders in young people and is one of the team in CAMHS in Monaghan. Caroline sheds light on the process of treatment and recovery. The room we used to record was adjacent to an echoey hallway, and some background noise has filtered through in places, but I hope you find the conversation helpful and hopeful. So Caroline and Sheila, thank you so much for agreeing to be part of this episode. So Sheila, can I come to you first and ask you about the beginnings for you of discovering that you had an eating disorder, or even before that?
Yeah, so I suppose when I realised I had an eating disorder, which is a very different thing to when you actually maybe had an eating disorder, I was 22 going on 23. So I was just finished college. I'd done drama and theatre studies in Trinity, had the best 4 years of my life. To everyone's mind, had everything. You know, I was on Gogglebox at the time. I had got first class honours. Like, you know, it was, you know, world my oyster was what was being told to me. And I always felt so guilty that I was like, but something doesn't feel right. There were so many options of things I thought I could do and wanted to do that I didn't know where to start. So instead I said, right, well, I'll work on myself then instead. And I will get fit and I will get healthy and I will do all of these things. And so between leaving in about, I would say, April of 2017, within about 3 months, I was very clearly unwell. I was working at Brown Thomas at the time, very focused on how you look. And my life became restricting my food, over-exercise. I was in a 24-hour gym and I could have been there for hours a day outside of work, as well as working the 12-hour shift I was doing. And I couldn't believe when I go to bed at night that I was going to have to wake up and do it all again. The cycle was there and I was stuck. Eventually sent a photo to my dad one day on my lunch break and he said he didn't recognise me.
So what I'm curious about, Sheila, in that is that you describe how you decided to work on yourself and get healthy.
In quotation marks.
Yeah, and what you describe, what followed wasn't necessarily healthy, and yet maybe it looked like healthy, you know, in terms of going to the gym and all of those things. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so as you say, it very much wasn't healthy, and that's why, you know, when we, during lockdowns and things, when people were saying everyone should get out and walk and everyone should be healthy and exercise, my thing I kept saying to people was that's not healthy for all of us, because for me that means doing everything to excess. So I have that kind of personality where I give everything my all. And I decided it was going to be small, I gave it my all. But it was so unhealthy, as you say. It was funny. It started as, God, you're great. You're doing brilliant. You look really well. Because you go through a phase where you do. And if you can stop there, fantastic. But I couldn't. And I just kept going and going. And eventually I noticed that I got a comment on a night out once being like, Jeannie, where have you gone? And I went home and I turned to my dad and I said, that wasn't a compliment. I was like, so I knew there was something off, and it was when things started to change and people's kind of comments to me started to change that I realised maybe it wasn't healthy. And then eventually when it became to the point where I wouldn't go to events and I would make excuses not to go, and if anything interfered with me, you know, restricting my food or going to the gym, like it was out of my day, that was it. And even I, you know, would injure myself and I would still be on that treadmill, like you couldn't get me off it. So that's when I knew it wasn't healthy, but I did not want anyone to stop me. I really didn't. And I was, even though then I got sent for referrals and I got sent to, you know, I got my referral and I put the letter in the top drawer and I thought, I got it now, that's fine, I won't do anything with it. I was still very reluctant to get that help. So eventually it got to the point where at, you know, 22, when I'm an adult, my parents had to kind of take charge, really. They did an intervention one night. They arrived at my door in Dublin, where I was living at the time, at about, I think it was 11 o'clock at night, and they said, you're coming home. And I said, no, I have work. And they were like, you're calling in sick. And that was it. And I needed the control to be taken away from me, because that's what it was. I was just, I couldn't stop myself.
And how did it get to that, for your parents to see that? You described sending a picture to your dad, yeah, and your dad saying he didn't recognise you. So, you know, can you talk to me a little bit about that piece for you?
Yeah, so I sent them the photo and he said he didn't know me. He said all he could see was eyes and teeth, and he was just shocked. And then I called him one day and said, I don't feel that well. Can I call in sick to work? And he said, of course you can. He's a HR consultant, so I ring him for everything. He said, of course you can. He said, but can I ask? He said, is this going to be an ongoing thing, or are you just sick today? And I said, I think this is going to be ongoing. And that was when he realised. He was like, it was me asking for help without asking for help. And I realise it now, but I was like, why did I call him? And why did I not just, if I didn't want help, I would have said, it's just today. But I didn't. I knew it was, like, I mean, I couldn't go 5 minutes without my tummy being in pain, or like I was in physical pain at this point. You know, things were starting to not work, and I was so sad. I was so sad. So I think I knew, it was that point that they knew they had to do something. And even then, when it came to me getting help, I was like, no, I'm an adult, I'll ring myself. I remember ringing, I went to Pat's, and that was where I got referred to, and I called, and I was kind of getting told, oh, you'll have an appointment in October, that's your assessment. And eventually my dad said, give me that number, and he rang and he said, if you don't give her an appointment now, I will not have a daughter to bring to you. Because I wasn't going to stop. Even though I was in the process of getting the help, my head, my little voice told me, well, until you get in there, you may as well keep going. You better be as sick as you can be before you get in there. Which is very unusual, because people kept saying, do you not want the help? I said, I do, but I don't. So the control was taken out of my hands. Then we just had to wait. Eventually, the appointment was made for August. So 2 months before I was meant to get it. And at that stage, like, it was quick, get her into inpatient. Okay. So
I'm guessing between the lines that you had lost a lot of weight and so on, but can you tell me, you know, how that was? Like, physically, how were you and those sorts of things?
We've realised now that I was actually showing signs of an eating disorder since maybe the age of 7. When, you know, I stood on a weighing scale for the first time, my granny, which we realise now since her passing and since I got sick, she had an eating disorder. We didn't know what it was for years. We now know what it was. And so her weight was talked about a lot. So I weighed myself in her house, and then it went on at 11. My mother then remembered me like pulling at my stomach and trying to, and she didn't know why I was doing it, but you know, we won't pay much attention. And then I was quite severely bullied in the start of secondary school, where I was not called fat, but muscly. Like, I'm very muscular. That was thrown at me as a negative. So I thought, if I could just get all of that a bit smaller and be less, quotes, manly, because I was called She-Man at times, I was like, maybe then, you know, I'd be left alone. So I was on a diet then, I'd say, from about fifth year. And I was like, I haven't been off one since. Even now in recovery, you know, I still wake up on Mondays and I'm like, Monday, diet day, you know. So that is still there. So this was what built up to it. And I had gone into the healthy eating stuff, and I was a sucker for any fad diet that you could do. Any detox, any detox, I did it all. And I would say, for someone who was a smart girl, you could trick me into doing any diet, any of them. So then come up to where I ended up then when I was at 22, and it just got to the point where I was cold all the time. That was probably one of the worst parts, was like, I mean, freezing in summer, and I couldn't wear a dress. I was covered up all the time, and even then, freezing. It's awful things that people don't realise. I always say, there's lots of things I didn't sign up for. I did not sign up for losing my hair. I did not sign up for my teeth going bad. And, you know, I don't ever like to talk about behaviours. I didn't purge. So that was purely from bad nutrition. So, you know, people make assumptions also a lot when you have an eating disorder that you did everything, all these types of behaviours. I didn't. And then I started to get fur. So you get hair everywhere, like little blonde hairs. Like you get them on your face, you get them on your arms. It's to keep you warm. My heart rate had dropped so low that I remember when I was inpatient in one of the first few weeks, I got rushed one night to do an ECG because my heart rate was just so slow. And it was just trying to keep me alive. I'd gone past the point of hunger, so I didn't feel that anymore. I felt no... I lost all my hunger cues. I've only actually got them back in the last year and a half. I'd really low blood pressure, so I was dizzy all the time. So I'd fall a lot. I still have scars on my legs and arms where I would have fallen. And where I lived, people knew. I mean, people knew me for years. So they knew I was unwell. And at this stage, I probably looked like I was about, you know, 14. Like I'd gotten so small and fragile looking. I got bed sores, so I couldn't lie in my bed because my mattress was hurting my back because my spine would hit against it. And I couldn't kneel either. It's even things like none of my clothes fit. I had these gorgeous dresses. I was in the debating society in school or in college. We wore black tie every week and none of the dresses would fit me. They just fell off me. And I almost wish like people knew that before they keep refusing the help. Like I never knew any of this.
As somebody that is supporting people with eating disorders now, I was listening to Sheila's story. What stands out for you in relation to where you are meeting people mm-hmm. on that journey?
I think just I'm nodding my head when Sheila's speaking, because the short-term advantages that there are to eating disorders in terms of, initially Sheila mentioned, you know, getting the plaudits, people complimenting you, feeling that sense of control, how it helps you to live your daily life, and it's so, in the short term, they're so beneficial when you're caught in an eating disorder. But it's very difficult for people with eating disorders to think of the long-term consequences of that. And I just think about even mindsets, where we talk about the physical manifestations of an eating disorder, and Sheila's listed a lot of those in terms of her heart being a muscle and the slowness of that, or, you know, all those physical manifestations are there. But I think about mindsets and the psychological manifestations that, you know, that all or nothing thinking that Sheila said, if I give it something, I give it everything. And it's a thinking style that we see commonly in people with eating disorders, or that she will go to the gym when you were injured. And that's another thing, that it's a driven type of exercise, whilst we've been bombarded with the media with, you know, healthy eating and, you know, exercise and things like that. We always think about things in terms of middle ground. So I think for somebody with an eating disorder, it's very much that that all or nothing perspective. We know that there's lots of things that contribute to an eating disorder, and I think Sheila's highlighted a lot of those, but perfectionistic type personalities can be one of the things. We always think about it like cooking a stew, that, you know, one of the ingredients going in might be the perfectionistic personality, or maybe the trigger of, you know, what was said to you at school, or life will be that little bit better, I'd feel more in control. And those sort of things go in together to contribute to the development of an eating disorder. And I think that's why it's so important when we're treating somebody with an eating disorder that we don't always get stuck on maybe the physical. We know that you have to be medically safe, you have to be medically alive. Your heart has to be working, your brain has to be refed. And we would see, you know, working with the physical manifestations as a necessary part, but also the mindset and what that is about, that all or nothing thinking, measuring your self-worth exclusively in terms of weight, shape and dietary control. You know, the research would say that eating disorders are cognitive disorders, and, you know, I agree with that, but I always think about what makes somebody think in that way. You were saying, Sheila, that you sort of thought your eating disorder developed at 7. You know, it's personality, our thinking style, early experiences, our self-esteem, our sense of effectiveness, what we can manage. And if we believe that life would be better if we could control one aspect of our life, than the work that we put into that to achieving that. And I think that's what keeps the eating disorder going, is that mindset that I would see in people that come to us.
There's a description of the eating disorder that there's functions for eating disorder. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that is, please?
I always think about what purpose does the eating disorder serve in your life, or how does it help you? So Sheila was clearly saying that, you know, the way that the control it gives you going to the gym and cutting back, and that could be for one person. But I think what eating disorders, that everybody has a different function, everybody has a different experience. For some young people, it may be a sense of comfort and containing. For others, we see it can be maybe communicating their anger because they don't have the verbal ability. For other people, it can be a sense of validation. You know, knowing that the research says that probably 42%, I think, is the number of young people that come to us with eating disorders, it's about rejection and abandonment. And it can be about the relationships with people. I think that relationship is so important, but there's always a different function. It can be a sense of security, communicating anger, give us control in life, maturation fears. Maybe people don't want to sort of take on the tasks of being an adult, so it's much easier to stay in the sort of the developmental tasks of being a child. They may not want to the physical development of their body, but there can be loads of different functions. It may be that they don't trust themselves, so they can't trust others in relationship. So this is a one friend, it can be an identity. So I think if we're going to have success in treating people with eating disorders, we need to know and understand that individual's mind. And I think getting to that is so important in treatment, because I think we can talk about all the different therapies, but it's being inside that person's mind and going on the journey with them and understanding and being mind-minded and predicting what they're thinking. And I think, again, you know, that's the one thing that we would always think, that the function of the eating disorder really here for us as a service takes priority over everything else.
It's not just sort of somebody acting out or you know, this idea that somebody's looking for attention, that's a bugbear for me for all sorts
it of is things. And I think that myth arises that, you know, I think we that this is people looking for attention. There's always a function to it, and nothing could be further from the truth, because a lot of these people, that young people that we see, they don't really want attention. They really just want to be contained and safe.
It's funny you say attention, because that's, I never wanted to not be noticed more. I didn't want anyone to see me. I did, and this is the girl, I studied drama. You know, I was on stage. I, for all the world, looked like I had all the confidence in the world. And I did when I was on stage. But I didn't feel like, I would walk, I remember walking through Dublin one day, and a man walked into me and knocked me on the ground. And I thought, that's how invisible I've made myself. Like, I just didn't want any attention. And it's funny you mentioned a few of the different functions. I think I've had a number of them. Like, it's popped up at different times to serve different functions. And at that time, it was, I'm out of college. What do? I need control. But then even I have to watch it. Like, my uncle died during COVID, and for 2 days I restricted my food. And I thought, why? And I, but thank God I'm vocal now. And I said to my parents, I'm restricting my food. I said, I don't know why.
Yeah.
You know,
what is this about for me?
Yeah.
And helping somebody to help you to understand what that's about.
Yeah.
Because there is an invisibility. You know, we see, I'm even thinking about comorbidities. Like, it's very rare we see somebody with an eating disorder without a comorbid presentation of maybe social anxiety. They'll get up on the stage and they'll be that person, but they're being somebody else. They're not being their genuine self. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, they want to disappear. They don't want to stand out in that place. Or somebody with OCD in terms of the certainty, the predictability. But I think everything serves the same function. And I think, you know, when we're treating somebody with an eating disorder, it has to be very individualised.
Yeah. Sheila, can I ask you about treatment? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're clearly very knowledgeable now. You're an expert in your own,
my own disorder.
Disorder, okay? I imagine that wasn't always the case. I imagine that you had to learn a lot. And so can you talk to me about being able to say to your parents last year when your uncle died, I've been restricting my food for 2 days, what's going on? Now, you don't get to that stage overnight to be able to do that. So can you talk to me a bit about that journey and that process for you of going from, you know, sort of being reluctant to go for help to being able to actually really clearly vocalise, there's something up and I need some help.
Yeah. Eventually I got my assessment that August, and they called it eating disorder, not otherwise specified. I think it's something else now. Mm-hmm. Is it? Yeah.
It's OSFED now, otherwise specified feeding and eating disorders.
Ah, okay. So that in my time it was EDNOS, but so they just didn't know where to put me because I took from so many different disorders and then the numbers didn't match. But they said they knew I was in trouble. They just said the rate at which I was dropping weight was just, they had to get me into an inpatient. So eventually, I think it was 2 days later, they had a surprise kind of discharge, and I got a call. And the night I got the diagnosis and was told what my disorder was, I went home and cried. The first time I got upset over it, and then I got admitted, and I just lay in my bed with my sister, and I was like, I can't believe I have to do this. And that day was, that was horrendous. I was never suicidal. I was low. I was never suicide. That day I thought, how do I get out of this?
Okay.
And I wondered, was that a way just to get out of having to do this? Okay. But I went in and I did it and I had my assessment and I had about 6 weeks in hospital. I thought, 5 weeks, I am out of here. I was like, can't wait for these people to come in here, make me better. I was like, aren't they wizards? I thought that's how it was going to happen. The time I really thought they were going to make me better and I didn't have to do a whole lot. And I went in like that. But I went in saying I was not going to eat this, I was not going to do that. They weren't going to make me do this. And I was very determined that they wouldn't change how I was, but they were going to make me better. So those first 6 weeks then were, they told me after them they were going to discharge me. And I remember being shocked because I hadn't got any psychological help at the time. I'd just been fed. That was what was done for me. And they said, you're not ready. And my parents, I think they nearly cried, like, you're not ready. And you have to go home and hit rock bottom. So anyway, they discharged me. I was devastated. But I went home. But me, I went home thinking then I was fine. They said I'm fine. I didn't hear, you're not bad enough yet or you're not ready yet. I didn't hear that. I went and I did my graduation and then it was Christmas of that year and things were awful. They got way, way worse and I don't even know how my parents sat there and well, I suppose that's all they could do. And eventually I looked at myself in the mirror in a changing room one day and I was like, I did not know the person in that mirror. It was like the first time I'd seen myself and I turned to her and I said, I need to go back in. And she went, thank God. And I went back in. And I went back in with a very different mindset. I was like, they tell me to drink my milk, I'll drink my milk. They tell me to eat that meal, as much as I don't want to, I will do it. Fine. And it was as hard, but I did what I was told. And I was like, if I want to beat this, I'm going to have to do what I'm told. So then I was in for 12 weeks then. And still it was very slow, but I came back out. And then this is where things got funny, you know, I came out and I'd gotten a bit of psychological help and things were starting to improve. I mean, the weight was, it was very slow and it went up and down as I came out. Then I went to outpatient care and they asked me a few times to go readmit myself a third time. And I said, I'm not coming back in here a third time. I said, I'm done. And they said, you might be a revolving door patient. And well, that was like a red rag to a bull. I was like, oh, will I? Well, I'll show you. And I was like, I'm getting better. So they put me into a program called Radical Openness, which is the best thing. Oh my God. So I had to wait 6 months to get it. So those 6 months, I was up and down. I kind of stayed the same. I mean, I wasn't making the weight gain I was supposed to be making, but I wasn't getting worse. And I was kind of doing little jobs here and there. And then I started Radical Openness and it was 6 months. And I was with people who didn't have eating disorders. I was with people who had anxiety and depression and addiction. And I could relate to them because I was addicted to my disorder and I was depressed because of my disorder. And I was like, I get it. And the homework they gave me from that was so challenging. And I credit that with changing things for me. I credit it with changing my life. And since then I've had to go on. I had to get my own counsellor, dietitian. I have a nutrition. I've quite a big team of people. I'm 4 years in now. I'm not recovered. But life is so much better. But it took an awful lot of trial and error.
Mm. Can you tell me about just examples of some of that homework? From the radical openness.
Yeah, and one I remember, which sounds so simple. I know I look back at it and I'm like, I can't believe I couldn't do that. So I was living in a town for 20 whatever years in Pleasanton and I would have said hello to everyone. I was so friendly and outgoing. Everyone, I knew everyone. And I suddenly, as I said, wanted to be invisible. I would walk with my hood up and I really did not want anyone to engage with me at all. I would go into a shop and I was mortified in a shop because part of my disorder was you don't want anyone to see you buying food. They'll think you're fat and greedy. So I didn't want people, I didn't even want a shopkeeper to see me buying food, so I wouldn't buy food. So they said, can you go into a shop and can you say hello to the shopkeeper when you buy something? And I was like, no, I can't. I can't do that. I was like, they'll think I'm fat. Like, that's how my brain worked. It was, no, I can't engage with them. I just want me to get out. And so one of my homeworks one week was to go in, just say hello to someone. If they engage in conversation, to give them back and don't cut the conversation. So to say, and how are you? Back to them. You know, and I was like, right, I'll do it. And I did it. And it wasn't that bad. And then another thing we had to do one week was, it was really hard. It was, you know, describe yourself. And I described myself. And then they said, is that how you describe yourself or how others describe you? I said, that's how others describe me. They're like, go home and figure out how you describe yourself. That to now has made me realise, I was like, God, I maybe am the person I was presenting as. I actually am all these other things. You know, the girl who doesn't cry, the girl who doesn't get upset, the girl who can take any slagging that she got, even the bullying in school, to be like, no, I'm actually quite sensitive. And I actually listen a lot and I take a lot in, despite how much I talk. You know, it was things like that, which sound so simple, but they were hard.
Yeah. Do you know what's coming across to me here, Sheila? And I don't know, Caroline, if you have any input to this, but what I'm hearing in this is I'm hearing about behaviour, I'm hearing about self-image, I'm hearing about being able, you know, walking with your hood down as opposed to making conversation in the shop. I haven't heard anything about food. And that's striking me as being quite profound, actually. Mm-hmm. And
it's accidental, actually, isn't it? Really?
But that's the bit that's standing out. And Caroline, what would you have to say about that?
You know, everything I think Sheila's saying is food, dietary weight and shape, they're not really the difficulty because they're the response to something. So when I think about recovery, I think just some of the things that you've spoken about in terms of, we know outcomes, you know, people tend to measure outcomes in terms of BMIs or what you're eating or whatever. It's important that physically we're well and alive and our brain is refed, because when our brain is refed, you can use radical openness DBT. But when our brain's not refed, our brain is starved, like the heart and the muscle slows down. And physically, a new nutritional rehabilitation is one part, a small part. You have to be alive. But I think sometimes what can weight restoration alone, the outcomes are poor, but it has to be that other piece that sort of helps you to find yourself and predict that you're effective in difficult, you know, manage your thoughts and feelings. Because I think for people with eating disorders, they have difficulty managing their thoughts and feelings and they've difficulty sitting with who they are and they want to be something else.
Yes. So I think sitting with who you are, that's the thing. It's having to sometimes just having to sit there and think. It's awful. So you distract yourself by thinking about the restriction or doing the exercise. But when I was forced to just sit and think, like even that, like, who are you? Who do you think you are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Because the last episode of Stories of Recovery was on addiction. And one of the contributors, Dermot, talked about his addiction to drugs and how it was to escape himself. And I'm hearing something around that in here, that the exercise and, you know, the obsessive and compulsive exercise and the restricting of the food sounds like something similar, mm-hmm. that's the distraction, that's the avoiding sitting with yourself. Mm-hmm. And Dermot talked about that too, about being comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm hearing that in you as well.
I always relate to people who have had addiction before. Mm-hmm. My counsellor is a recovering alcoholic and I met her and I came out and was like, she gets me. Mm-hmm. And it was because I absolutely was addicted to, I called the voice Janine. I was addicted to her. I had to have her. I had to have the exercise. Like, it was, as much of it was compulsive and I was totally addicted to it. And I kept saying to people, yeah. I was like, but who am, what am I without that? I was like, don't take that away. I wanted to just hold on to it. Anytime anything bad has happened, I went to the gym.
It is sitting with your thoughts. We're seeing a lot of particularly young boys coming to us now at this stage with, it's like an addiction to the gym. They want a certain type of body look, and you know, one of the questions we ask is, what would happen if you didn't go to the gym? And a lot of them would be saying, you know, when they think about it and they reflect on it, in the short term, going to the gym dampens down the negative mood states and the negative thoughts. But they said what they'd be left with is, I'd be thinking, and I hear them saying, I should go to the gym, and you do more, and you want another wee bit more, and you want another wee bit more. But some of them would say back, if I'm left without going to the gym, I could end up feeling irritable, depressed, and suicidal. So to avoid those feelings, they go to the gym, because it gives them a sense of control. Mm-hmm. Again, I keep coming back to what we said at the very beginning, middle ground. We keep revisiting all or nothing thinking. It's great to go to the gym, but it's great to go at that level. So look, at recovery is not linear, it goes in ups and downs. But I think it's so important that your support service is with you, and that if you get the right treatment early and go to your sort of, you know, the best options that's available out there. You know, I think for parents and carers, what's a diet that the young person is engaged in? How does that become an eating disorder? And where does that split? And for parents going to GP, they may say, she's on a diet, this is normal. Because a lot of teenage girls are on diet. But when does it become an eating disorder? And I don't know whether Sheila will agree with this or not, but I often think it's when it starts to consume you and you measure your self-worth in terms of weight, shape, dietary control, gym, that, you know, your sense of self, your effectiveness is measured in outside things. Like how you look, what you do, achievement, perfectionism, the should word, the rules, sticking to the rules, having to do certain things so that you don't experience negative thoughts and feelings. And I think that's for me when it becomes an eating disorder. You know, BodyWise have so many absolutely excellent, they're running peer-led resilience for carers. They run the Maudsley for carers. They've got support groups for parents. They've got support groups for over 19s, for 13 to 18, 17. And they're even looking at their website, just in terms of how to broach somebody the subject of an eating disorder. How do you do that? It's done in a graded way, in a supportive, compassionate, concrete way. And so no one went to leave the conversation. But there's so much out there on BodyWise's website for people and educating themselves. They've got resources for GPs, resources for parents. Have a look, because there is plenty of support available from BodyWise.
And what kind of signs and symptoms would be, you know, because I'm making an assumption here, but maybe the person with the eating disorder may well be covering things up and hiding things.
Absolutely.
But what kind of things would parents and carers or friends maybe be looking out for?
Well, I think just in terms of, you know, because we haven't spoken much about food and weight and shape, but it may be things like cutting out meals or cutting out food groups, calorie counting, you know, saying to parents or carers, I've already eaten. A noticeable weight loss, but the psychological things as well, in that they become more isolated, they don't have the same interest in the things they used to, their hobbies are going by the wayside, friends aren't calling as much anymore, that you might notice them doing a lot of exercise, maybe going to the bathrooms after meals, and maybe just not being themselves in terms of their mood being low, being irritable. And again, you know, a lot of the research would say that a lot of, you know, disorders start at a much earlier age than when people actually get to treatment, and how we have that first conversation with a young person if we're worried. It's really about not setting expectations too high and being sort of that open communication. I'm worried about you because I've noticed this or I've noticed that. CAMHS can always be rang, or adult service can always be rang, just in terms of parents are concerned or carers are concerned. I think it's good to pick up the phone, because again, you know, there are a lot of young people that are on diets, there's some disordered eating, and it may not warrant, you know, a referral to us, but it's, you know, if in doubt, just pick the phone up.
Sheila, can I ask you then what recovery means to you?
It almost, when you say it there, it almost makes me smile, or it's a more of an exciting thing. It was a terrifying thing, but I remember, I have a diary and I haven't read back over it, but I know what the first page says, and it says, I will never have to do day one again. And it says that on it. I know it's there, I won't read it, but I know it's there. And I never have had to do day one again. So as awful as we said, it wasn't linear, but it has never gotten as bad. And now, like, life is really good. Like, there's lots of things I still wish I could, that I still will have to challenge and tackle. And there's days where, you know, I don't feel so sure of myself, or that kind of lack of self, or that lack of self-worth comes in. But now it's an exciting opportunity, in that I can, it allowed me to try lots of new things. I had to try new hobbies. I had to try and develop a healthy relationship with exercise because it was something I was always sporty, so I knew I was going to do it. But mm-hmm. I tried lots of things. I did, you know, I did running. I did different types of gym classes. And now I've discovered what it is that helps me be, you know, healthy at exercise. I have lots of friends. I feel like I offer something to them. I enjoy being with my family. Like, I really didn't enjoy occasions before. I do now. I even think of things like, I have a cat and I love her and I like look after her and stuff. I couldn't even look after myself back a while ago, so I wouldn't be looking after something else. And yeah, there's lots of positives. It also means though that I have to be aware that I can't let life take over to the point that I neglect my recovery. So like some days I'll realise I've been out all day and then I've missed a meal or something. I'm still on a meal plan where I eat at certain times. Lots of people would be past that at this stage. Look, I'm just not, but I have to accept that that's okay. So there's still lots of things to work on and I have to be aware of that, but there's so many opportunities and so many things that have come from recovery.
In terms of your sort of daily maintenance, what are non-negotiables for you to stay well?
That I do things on my terms.
Okay.
In that I'm not always trying to people please. I'm sure that's something you see a lot. I just wanted everyone to be happy. So I'd be the type that if there was three parties on in one night, I'd go to all three because I didn't want to let someone down. Now, like for example, we're going out tonight. If I get tired, I will say, I am tired, I'm going home. Because I know that if I leave it too late, then I might wake up late the next morning, I might skip breakfast, I know there's knock-on effects. So when I need to do something for me, I just say it. I prep my food, so I don't give myself a choice, because what'll happen is my head starts to negotiate portion sizes or what I'll have or whether I'll just skip something. And then also allow myself to do things that suit me and not, oh, if it's something I really don't want to do or it's something that's really going to impact on me, I'm able to say no now. So, yeah. And I also have a counsellor, a dietitian and a nutritionist. I also have a coach for the gym. Because I started Strong Woman, which is like weightlifting and things. And oh, that was one of the most empowering things I've ever done. I suddenly realised, like, I have to eat to do this. I'm really strong. Like, my muscle is now what everyone used to bully me about is an advantage. Like, people are like, in admiration of that I can do this. But I need a coach to tell me, you're doing 4 days and then you're not. So I'll obey kind of the rules, because I love rules. I'll obey those rules, but if I was left to my own devices, I might do too much. I won't do that if I'm told. So it's having all that backup.
And what about you, Caroline? What does recovery mean to you?
Everybody that I've seen, I think it's meant something different to everybody. And I think, you know, it can be in stages, different expectations at different times. And we know it's not linear. Even some of the things that Sheila has said there, when I hear of her experience at the beginning about the meticulous, rule-bound, driven exercise, but everything being at the top end of the spectrum, where I hear now there's still rules, but they're more bendable or they're more flexible.
Yeah.
And they're guidelines as opposed to rules, which I think is a really big step in recovery. You know, one of the things we talk about with young people is that it takes a long time. It's not 40 sessions of CBT and weight restoration alone. It's something about being able to sort of be yourself, be genuine, manage difficult thoughts and feelings, manage difficult experiences without having to pull the severity of that eating disorder in. But enjoying life as opposed to existing, because I think with an eating disorder, you're just existing.
So Sheila, throughout all of this, you've shared a lot about your journey, your story, your recovery. What about silver linings? Are there silver linings in this for you?
Yeah, I think the massive silver lining for me is I discovered what my passion is and what motivates me, and that's work and my career. And if I had never ever gotten sick, I wouldn't be in radio, because I knew I wanted to do it, but being sick meant that I couldn't work full time. I couldn't work at all. So I went to my local radio station and said, look, I'm not that well. I was like, but I really want to learn about this. Can I come in one day a week? They said, we've no money, we've no job for you. I said, that's fine. So I just come in every Wednesday. And I went in every single Wednesday. Sick, not sick, doing well, not having a good day. And I kept on going and going. And as I started to improve, then a job came up in there, a very small one, and they gave it to me. And then I started to get more experience and move on. And then got the job, that got me the experience to get the job in Northern Sound, and then now I'm moving on again to the next chapter, I think. Okay. So that has been the biggest silver line. And the second one, I suppose, is discovering what I actually like. You know, I made it when I was in college, I was the party animal, the go out, do this, do everything. And now I'm the person who lives, I live by myself. I like to come home from work and take a bit of time for me. I like to do crafts and things like that. Never did that before. I like baking. Never did that before. And now I like a totally different type of exercise that I thought I'd be afraid of, because my association with weightlifting and stuff before was you'll be that muscly thing you were bullied for. And I've kind of come full circle and realised what I actually like and the person that I want to be. So and then also getting to speak about it is very empowering as well. So lots of silver linings, I think.
That's lovely. Can I ask you, Caroline, about silver linings, you know, in your experience with working with people with eating disorders?
I think one of the big things I see is learning about themselves. They sort of understand themselves more, and the skills that they develop, you know, that they use for the rest of their life in terms of being effective, how to tolerate difficult situations, how to be confident, competent, and learning the thoughts and feelings that we can manage them, and we can, you know, we can override the storm, or we can sort of, when adversity comes our way, that we have different skills to deal with it. Where I work in CAMHS, a lot of the young people, you know, by the time they're finished with us, they're coming out the other end. So, you know, and keeping in contact and seeing how they blossom in life and the things that they've learned through, you know, their experience with us that stand to them, you know, their life. And being grateful for their families. Because we tend to appreciate the smaller things more when we've been through something like this. And I sometimes find at the start of an eating disorder that people can't appreciate the simple things in life. But they learn as the journey goes on that the simple things in life, they can sort of sit and read the paper or have a bun or, you know, go out with their friends. And they missed out on that, but they really end up at the end of treatment sort of appreciating those smaller things in life. They're grateful. Mm. And I always think gratefulness is a hard thing. I think people always say, oh, being grateful for things, but it's a really hard thing to sort of instill in your mind.
And that's interesting, because your office here is full of thank you cards.
Yes. But I learn something from the people I see as well. And, you know, I'm really lucky working with great people in CAMHS that are really interested. It's more than a job. You have to be really love it too. You have to be patient. You have to, you know, you're there for the long haul. It's not for 6 months or a year. It's longer. So you get to know people in this. You get to know them so well. But you know, every case we see, we're learning something new from everybody. We learn so much from the people that come to see us.
So there we leave the conversation. You can contact CAMHS, that's the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, in Monaghan on 047 95444, and in Cavan on 049 4378 920. The Adult Mental Health Services contact in Monaghan is 047 95300, and in Cavan on 049 4353 145. Caroline referred to the website Bodywise, where there's a great range of reliable information and valuable resources. Visit www.bodywise.ie, and Bodywise is spelt BODYWHYS. There's also a website for National Eating Disorders Association, which you can visit on www.nationaleatingdisorders.org. If you would like to avail of support or information on services for yourself or someone you know, you can visit the HSE website www.yourmentalhealth.ie for general information, as well as how and where to get support. You should always contact your GP, doctor, or other health professional you might be in contact with if you have concerns about your mental health and well-being. In the event of an emergency, call 999 Emergency Services if you or someone you know is at risk of harming themselves. For further resources and information on recovery and promoting mental health and well-being, please visit www.mentalhealthireland.ie/resources, where there are a wide variety of downloadable resources, webinar recordings, videos and links that are informative and supportive, including family recovery, farming and mental health, mindfulness practices, recovery colleges and more. Thanks for listening and goodbye.